about electrogravimetry, and I called it controlled potential electrolysis. So let me just quickly do that review. I already did a review. You asked a question. We did sort of a review. But the idea with this controlled potential electrolysis technique, now, electrogravimetry is just one permutation of it. By the end of class, I'm going to give you five applications of controlled potential electrolysis in various areas of electrochemistry, most of them sort of analytical in nature, but not all of them. So it's controlled potential electrolysis that we're doing. We're controlling the potential. We're electrolyzing the solution. It's an electrolytic cell. We are applying a potential. We use the Nernst equation to determine that potential based on the E0 of the system, of the particular chemical system that we're working with. And we need to apply a potential sufficient to cause the reaction to occur. We're talking about reductions, because in electrogravimetry, we're going to plate something out and weigh it, so it's going to be reducing an ion to a metal in 99% of the cases. There are systems that you can plate out. I gave you an example of one earlier. I slipped it by you. You weren't thinking about it. But that was the idea of anodizing a piece of silver wire. When you anodize a piece of silver wire, you take a piece of silver wire and you put it into the into a solution, put an oxidizing potential on it, put into a solution of containing chloride ions. You put an oxidizing potential on it, a positive potential on it, and negative ions will actually plate out, some negative ions. In the case of the silver chloride system, we plate chloride ions out onto the surface of silver. Right? So most of the time when we do these experiments, we're doing metals. They're cationic. We put a negative potential. We cause the reduction of the metal ion to the metal atom on the surface of the electrode, and we plate out the metal. But we could do it the other way also. Some systems work, for example, the silver and chloride system works, and I can plate chloride ions out onto the surface of silver. Now, I'm forming silver chloride on the surface, so the chemistry is right for that to work. Can I do nitride ions? It doesn't work. Right? The chemistry is not right for nitrate to plate out onto the surface of the silver. There's not a silver nitrate insoluble compound that will plate out. But silver chloride is insoluble and will plate out onto the surface of a silver wire. So the chemistry has to be right. We can do the electrochemistry. There are certain systems that you can do that you can plate out anions. They stick as maybe an insoluble species on the surface of the electrode. They're not very tightly held. The case of plating out a metal onto the surface of the electrode, it is tightly held, right? It is fairly well bound. And I mentioned the system that we use for jewelry, right? We make jewelry, we plate gold on it, and so forth. In the old days, everybody used to talk about plating out chromium, because cars used to have chrome bumpers. Now everything's made of plastic. Right? But in the old days, the cars had these big steel bumpers, and to make them look pretty, well, I guess we can think about your Harley. Okay, anybody got a Harley Davidson motorcycle parked in the parking lot? Well, they're all chrome, right? They got a lot of chrome on these motorcycles, and so they, what do? They plate, they make an electrochemical cell, and they plate chromium out onto the surface of these parts, and make them nice and shiny. They're not solid chromium, okay? They just have a surface coating of chromium on the metallic steel part. Okay, so I've already spent more time than I wanted to in reviewing. We were talking about copper, good example. This electrogravimetry is used for copper. And I mentioned the two assumptions that are inherent in our system. Typically, all the copper is plated out, and there are sample examples where we might not plate out all of the copper. But typically, all the copper is plated out, and then nothing else plates out in order for us to do this experiment. I talked to you about the Nernst equation and how we and the chemical reactions and the E0s, and we talked about, well, this is the overall reaction for the system. I think I talked about all this stuff. Anyway, an E for the cell, E for the cathode minus E for the anode, and I set up the system for you, and you're supposed to do the calculation and come up with a number. You don't have to come up exactly with this number, but you ought to come up with a number in that neighborhood somewhere, depending on what you use for the different concentrations here. Okay. So, based on that calculation, now you asked the question this morning, for zero current. Well, I talk about the Nernst equation basically saying that the applied potential is in equilibrium with the concentrations that are in solution. So, when the two things are in equilibrium, they're exactly balanced, the net current flow is zero. Okay? The net current flow is zero. So I apply, let's see, negative 0.91. So if I apply a potential less negative of negative 0.91, that's the number I came up with. So if I apply a potential of negative 0.5, somebody blinked. Okay. Sometimes that happens. Fortunately, my computer is on a battery, so it doesn't happen to my computer. And actually, the computer, we'll see what happens. So if I apply a potential less negative than that, the concentration, so the less negative E, then what the Nernst equation is going to tell me is that the concentration of copper in my solution when I reach equilibrium is going to be higher. Oh, when I go a little more negative, then I'll lower that concentration. Okay, I'll create a greater driving force for the cathodic reaction, the reduction of copper ions to copper metal at the electrode surface. And so what we're doing is we're setting up a system. We're gonna figure out the voltage that we need to plate out the copper. Well, you said, why not just jack up the voltage more negative? I told you, if you go too negative, you're going to get other stuff. Okay, you're going to get other ions that are in solution. We don't want other ions. That's going to cause weight. If I start plating out lead out of the system, or cadmium, or zinc, or something else that might be in there, then I'm going to have an error on the positive side. If I don't put a sufficient potential on the system, and I come to equilibrium, I put only negative 0.5 volts on the system, and I come up with a concentration, some significant concentration of copper still left in the solution. I didn't plate it all out. I plated a lot of it out. I got 90% of it. I got a 10% error if I only plated out 90% of the copper, and the system gradually comes to an equilibrium. Thank you. And it comes to an equilibrium at that voltage that I applied, which, according to the Nernst equation, gives me some concentration of copper ions still left in the solution, and I don't want those copper ions. I want to get that down to some really low value. So, what we were talking about was applying a potential. I calculate the equilibrium potential, and maybe I apply a potential slightly more negative, all right? And we talked about 99.9% or whatever it is, and I apply a voltage that's slightly more negative, and I end up with, hey, we're back. I end up with a very, very small copper concentration in solution. Choose cathodic potential to reduce the equilibrium copper to any desired value. The desired value being 99.9 or the boss says, look, give me a quick number on this. I don't care. If it's plus or minus 10%, okay. The client is waiting in his car outside for the answer. And so so you plan it out and you say, well, I'm in a hurry and I can't let this go completely, but we'll get an answer. We'll tell him whether it's one molar or two molar, or whatever. So you can get any desired value you want depending on the potential you set. Be cautious not to set potential too far. You reduce other things. We normally set the conditions so the reduction is completed in a reasonable set of time. I'll show you the system that we have for This is the actual electrodes right here. These are the electrodes, the actual what they look like. Okay, when I was an undergraduate, this was part of the curriculum. You had to do an electrogravimetry experiment in the analytical chemistry laboratory, and I said, "Oh, I'll never use this again. This technique is old-fashioned," and so forth. Since I've been here at UMass Lowell, I've had two companies come from the outside and want to do this. Okay, they want to do this. Now, I'll give you. I'll tell you the one application. This is a very accurate technique, and there's a foundry in Nashua, New Hampshire, a foundry where they actually make blocks of various metals. Okay, in other words, they make gold blocks, gold bars. But that's not their main business. They make brass, bronze, various alloys. Okay, and they sell these to companies who are going to melt that down and make something out of it. But they supply high purity metals to the other industries that need the high purity metals. So they send them off a few bricks of brass or bronze or, you know, you name it, whatever the metal happens to be. Well, they said we have need of an electrogravimetry measurement, and it has to be electrogravimetry because this is how we certify that we have the amount of copper in the system. And it was copper that they wanted, and I think it was either brass or bronze. Bronze has higher copper. Both are alloys, and both have copper in them, high amount of copper. And they wanted to know the amount of copper. He said, "Well, why don't you just scrape a piece off, dissolve it in acid, and do it by atomic absorption?" Well, you can do it that way. The problem is that there are several errors that come into play with the getting a chunk of the metal off of the block of brass or bronze, weighing it, okay, a small amount of it, dissolving it in an acid, diluting it to volume in a volumetric flask, diluting it way down because you can't measure high concentrations of the copper with atomic absorption. You have to measure atomic absorption or other spectroscopic techniques measure low concentrations. They measure part per million concentrations. But I've got percent quantities. You know, I've got an alloy that's 80% copper. You know, bronze, I don't know, it's very high. Well, I got to dilute that way down. There's error associated with the sampling, with the weighing, with the serial dilution that you make to dilute the sample down to low concentration. And then atomic absorption is on a good day, is considered plus or minus 1 to 2%. Okay, that's a good day. You know, that's in the manufacturers. I told you that they lie anyway. But you know, so you might be better off. You might be more likely to get 2 to 3% in routine use. By the time you add all those errors up, you got a several percent error in the measurement. They said it's not tolerable. We need to know the copper level in this alloy better than much better than 1%. Okay, much better than 1% accuracy. It might have been in the 0.1% range. Some of them they certified to 5.9s, right? 99.999. You're only going to get that with a technique like this. So we had to do electrogravimetry. So it comes up. We use a device. The device is a black box. Okay, I'll explain what's inside the black box. The sample goes into the beaker, and these two electrodes go into the beaker. Now, the way this works is these two electrodes are platinum, and they're platinum gauze. So it looks like a piece of screen, very fine screening, fine mesh screen, made out of platinum. So that's what this is. That's what this device is. Obviously, it connects electrically to my black box. This anode device goes inside of here. And you notice the shape of it. It's sort of star-shaped. It's sort of shaped. Yeah. I failed art. Okay. It's sort of star-shaped like this. I don't know. And it spins on its axis. What's it doing? It's stirring the solution. So this is going inside of here, and it's stirring the solution because if I want to get all of the copper ions that are in the solution, I got to have convective mass transport. That's the way I'm going to get efficient plating of the ions in the sample. So I'm going to get convective mass transport. I'm going to get that by spinning this electrode. So that's what's in here. Now, this little beaker, if you look at it, they show a little curly anode. It doesn't really matter, but in my case, and then what I've used experimentally of this type, where the anode is spinning and stirring the solution. So I got my two electrodes, okay, in my beaker, and if it's copper, it's probably got a blue color to it, and I'm doing my experiment. Now, in this one, they show a stir bar. In my case, we spin the electrode. Now, let me tell you about what's inside the black box and how we're doing this. It's electrolysis, so we got to have a power supply. All right, we got some kind of a power supply. It's referred to as a potentiostat. Stat meaning constant, potentio meaning potential, right? Potentiostat. So I'm going to fix the potential at some value. What value? The value calculated using the Nernst equation. You calculate the number, negative 0.91 or whatever it comes out to be, and I apply the potential with the potentiostat. I dial, turn the dial, and I come up with the value that I want on the dial that I'm applying to the voltage that I'm applying to the electrodes. So that voltage from here, the anode side goes to the positive side goes to the anode. Okay, we don't care about that, but it has to be there. We need it. And then the negative part, the cathodic potential, the part that's going to cause the reduction, goes to the cathode where we're going to see the copper played out. And the little wire mesh thing is white platinum metal, and it becomes copper colored as the experiment goes on. And so that's the way this is done. Now, I've got a couple of meters in here. I've got a voltmeter between the positive and negative poles of my power supply, my potentiostat, and that's telling me what the potential is that's applied to the system. Okay, that's telling me the potential that's applied to the system. And then I have an ammeter. That's telling me how much current is flowing through the system. Electrons are flowing, right? They're coming out of here. The electrons are coming out of here, and they're going over here, and they're going in here, and at the surface of the electrode, they're meeting up with copper ions, and two electrons plus one copper atom, copper ion, creates a copper atom, which plates out onto the surface of the mesh, of the platinum mesh. And we're also, at the same time, extracting here we're gaining electrons. The copper is gaining electrons in the anode side of things. An oxidation is occurring. Something is losing electrons, right? Something is losing electrons on the anode side of things, and that's the basic system. Okay, that's how it works. I look at the ammeter. We talked about zero current already this morning. I watch the ammeter, and what happens? In the beginning of the experiment, I got lots of current. Okay, lots of current. The needle's way up there. And then with time, it's dropping down, and it's dropping down, and it's dropping down, until it gets to a point where there's zero current flowing in the system. Right? Zero current flowing in the system. Just like your gas gauge on your car. Right? Exactly how much, what the volume of gasoline in your car is, you don't know. And you don't really care. All you care about is when it gets down to the E, okay, it means you got to take out another loan to get a gallon of gas. Okay, so you're just looking at that as an indicator of what's going on. We're not making a measurement. We're not taking a reading off of that ammeter and saying, oh, the current is X or Y, because this is electrogravimetry. I'm going to weigh. My only measurement that I'm going to record is the measurement of how much the electrode weighs, how much it weighs when I'm done with the experiment. So I do this experiment in that way. Likewise, the voltmeter is there just for me to set things. It's like the speedometer on your car, right? Okay, I set the cruise control, so I'm going 55 miles an hour. I won't get a speeding ticket, right? That's what I'm doing here. I'm just setting the voltage at the right voltage for the experiment to be carried out under the conditions that I've described previously. All right. Now, there's a problem. Well, there's always a problem. Okay, there's a problem. There's a problem with simple electrogravimetry, or a simple system that I defined, because the cathode voltage is not accurately known. Okay, it's not accurate. No, so E applied is E for the cathode. So the E that I am applying, all right, is some value that we are going to calculate with the Nernst equation. So that's what this is. So E applied, right? I'm calculating this with the Nernst equation. But the E for the system, okay, the E for the system that I've set up is not just the E for the cathode, because there's other E's, there's other potentials in the system. We talked before about the junction potential. Well, we don't have that problem here because we don't have. I told you that the junction potential is really significant when we have two dissimilar solutions in contact with each other. We don't have two dissimilar solutions here. There's only one solution, and it's metallic electrodes in contact with that solution. So I told you there is a junction potential, but it's so small because there's a junction, right? It's a solid metal electrode in contact with a solution. So there is a phase barrier there, a phase boundary, and there is a junction, but it's insignificant. It's completely insignificant, any potential that might develop there as a junction potential. So we don't have to worry about the junction potential. But there are other things that we do have to worry about. As a matter of fact, there are three problems. These are the three problems. Okay? Those three problems are that the E for the entire system is defined not only by the E for the cathode, but by the E for the anode. And you say, I know what that is. I know what the E developing at the anode is because we said it was going to be the oxidation of water. Right? Remember? I gave you the H2O. Remember H2O? Anyway. Oxidation of water is going on at the anode, so I could know that. I could know what the E at the anode is, except there's a problem. As the experiment goes along, remember what happens? The water is producing oxygen, right? We're basically producing oxygen and hydrogen, and things are changing through the course of the experiment, right? If I'm producing oxygen, then the concentration of oxygen may be changing in the system. If I'm producing hydrogen, the concentration of hydrogen is changing during the system, or in the system. So if things are changing, if the concentrations change, we know from the Nernst equation that when things change on the right-hand side, when that far right-hand term, the concentration term, changes, the E for that half cell changes. So the problem is that during my experiment, the E for the anode half cell changes. In the beginning, it starts out at some value, and throughout the course of the experiment, it may be changing. All right, we're producing oxygen, we're producing things, we're using up, or generally, in that case, we're electrolyzing water and we're producing things. As a matter of fact, here's the reaction. Okay, a similar problem exists. All right, so in my notes here, I talked about the IR and the overvoltage first. And today I'm talking about the anode first. But here, the problem exists at the anode. It's this reaction. Okay? Sorry, this reaction. So, oxygen's being produced. Well, if I keep the system well stirred and purge it and keep it in equilibrium with oxygen in the atmosphere, all right, I can minimize the oxygen problem. I can keep it at about 0.2 partial pressure of oxygen because that's what's in the air, and I'll just stir out the excess oxygen and maybe that'll work. It might not work because you're producing oxygen in the solution. It's going to take time for it to come out. The oxygen levels in the solution are going to get high before you're able to move them out, and you probably won't be at equilibrium with the air. Hydrogen's another problem because I'm going to be building up hydrogen ions in my system. It's going to be getting more and more acidic as I electrolyze water at the anode. So I got a problem. I don't know what the overall E for my system is, even if I want to control the E for the cathode. How am I going to do that if I only know some of the E's? Okay, if I want to I apply this, so I dial this in, E applied. I want a certain value for the E for the cathode, but E for the anode is messing me up because it's changing throughout the course of the experiment. I also mentioned before that previously in the last class, I think we talked about E for the IR drop. We might have talked about it for the last two classes, or in the last two classes. But the fact that current flowing through a resistance produces a voltage. I already told you that I'm watching my current meter, and when I start the experiment, I got a high current, but throughout the course of the experiment, that current is dropping off, and ultimately, it goes to zero current. So I changes throughout the experiment. R is pretty fixed, pretty much fixed. The resistance of the solution is constant throughout the experiment. You know, it's got salt in there. It's got a fixed resistance. It stays the same. So I changes, the R does not change. Resistance doesn't change, the current does. So the voltage caused by this one factor in my overall potential of my system is changing throughout the course of the experiment. That's another problem. Then I've got the overvoltage problem. Depending on the system, I may have a certain overvoltage. I don't know what it is. Depends on the particular system that I'm using, copper or whatever. Depends on the electrodes that I'm using, platinum in this case, whatever, gold I could use, some other material. So I've got all of these problems that give me a difficulty in knowing what to apply in order to get. All I really care about is this. All I care about is E for the cathode. All I want to do is apply the right potential to plate out copper and only copper in my electrogravimetry system. So what we do is we go to a three-electrode system. Now, I warned you in advance that I was going to tell you about a three-electrode system. All right? It's not difficult. It's really simple. I have an amazing knack of making difficult things simple. So here's what happens. We can eliminate all the problems with this three-electrode system. Now, the diagram looks a little bit complicated. You can read all these words later. No, you can read them now if you want to. But you can listen to me now. Now you should listen to me. So here's my system. This is my electrochemical cell. This is one electrode. This is another electrode. This is another electrode. Now, we've seen these before. The working electrode, the thing that I'm interested in, my cathode, is here. Okay, so this is where the copper is actually going to plate out. My copper ions are going to go over here and plate out and become copper metal. The counter electrode is the anode. So in voltammetry, any electrolytic type system, we refer to a working and a counter electrode. This is the two places where the bulk of the current is flowing and where we're getting our electrochemical reactions that we've been talking about going on. There's a third electrode. The third electrode is the reference electrode that we've talked about before. Same silver chloride reference electrode. Now, what I do is I set up my system. Okay, I set up my system. Here's my power supply. It's electrolysis. I've got to have a power supply. We called it a potentiostat. It's a device for supplying power. Negative juice is, you know, electrons are going this way. They're going to my cathode. I'm plating out ions as metal, and that's cool. Everything's good. On the other side of my power supply, I work my way down here, okay, to the anode. Or if you want to think about the electrons flowing this way, right, electrons are actually flowing this way. And why do I have this squiggly thing here? That's a slide wire. That allows me to adjust the voltage. Okay, I went down to the physics department on the first floor, went into their stock room. They got all sorts of cool stuff in there. All right, you know, electronic gizmos and gadgets. And I get one of these little slide wires. It's just a coil of wire with a slider thing on it that I slide back and forth, and it allows me to adjust the voltage that's applied to the system. So I did the calculation, like you're doing for homework. I calculated what the voltage is that I needed in order to electrolyze the system and get copper to plate out. I said, okay, negative 0.91. So I hook up my system like this, and I slide this little thing up and down here until I get 0.91 volts reading on my meter. Okay, the meter's not... Well, I'll talk to you about the meter in a minute. All right, so everything's cool. What's the rest of this about? So this part of the system is basically what we talked about before. All I've done is add this part of the system. I've added two things. I've added a reference electrode, and I've added a voltmeter. This is my voltmeter. The reason I did it hanging off the side over here is because all I care about is the voltage that's applied to the working electrode. So I want to make a measurement of the potential at the working electrode, and the only reliable way I'm going to do that is to measure it versus a reference electrode. Because remember, a reference electrode is constant. It gives you the same potential no matter what the composition of the solution is. That was how I defined it back in day one when we started electrochemistry. It makes no difference. Its potential is independent of solution concentration. So I'm measuring the potential between these two electrodes, between this electrode and this electrode. I'm measuring it with this device. I know I need negative 0.91 volts. I set it up to negative 0.91 volts. The current is flowing. Okay, my current ammeter is reading. And it begins to drop off as I played out stuff. Things are happening in the solution. All kinds of stuff's happening in solution, right? Current is flowing through a resistance, and I'm getting a potential change due to the I dropping off. I've got some overvoltage that I don't know what it is for the particular system, and so I'm concerned about that. I have my anode reaction is producing oxygen and hydrogen ions, and I don't know at any given moment in time what those concentrations are, so I don't know what that half cell is putting out. But I do know the important thing, and that important thing is I'm measuring the voltage at my cathode. If that voltage changes, I quickly go over to my little slide wire and I boost it up a little. If the voltage drops below negative 0.91, I push it back up to negative 0.91. Okay? And I sit there and I get a cup of coffee, okay, a good book, and I keep watching. Ooh, it changed a little bit. Move it. Okay. Now we could hire a monkey to do that, all right? We could train a dog and give him a little doggy treat every time he moved the slide wire over, okay? We could do something instead of using your valuable time to do that, but I only explain it this way because this is how it was originally invented. Somebody came up with this idea and said, hey, this works, all right? And they hired a graduate student to do the work for him, right? And they said, here, just watch this, okay, and move this every time the current drops off. All right, so today, we can go again across the catwalk to my friends in electrical engineering and say, build me a system that will do this automatically, okay, because I don't have this kind of time on my hands, all right? And the dog died, I don't know. And so I need something to, the monkey doesn't, you know, joined a union and got unionized and he won't do this work anymore. And so so we get the electrical engineers, and they use some operational amplifiers and some feedback circuitry, right? And every time the voltage begins to change, there's a feedback mechanism that boosts the voltage back up. And very easy to build a potentiostat, okay, a device that keeps constant potential based on a three-electrode system, So today, all electrochemistry involving electrolytic cells, which I refer to as voltammetry. All voltammetry, okay, is done with three-electrode systems. Very, 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 very rare to find a two-electrode system in electrochemistry anymore. You could still do, you could do electrogravimetry with a two-electrode system, and they do make systems. They make systems for doing it. For kind of crude electrochemistry, but you could do it with two electrode system. It still works, but you got problems that are uncontrolled, variables that are uncontrolled. You can use two electrode systems in ultra, if you're using ultra micro electrodes. I'll talk more about those in about four classes. Okay, but I won't talk much about them. Okay, three electrode configuration involves a reference electrode, which maintains a fixed potential, doesn't change no matter what the solution concentration or composition is. My working electrode, which is the electrode of interest, and that's my cathode and is where the work is going on. And then I have the counter electrode. The bulk of the current, okay, flows between the working electrode and the counter electrode. If you're in England, they call it the auxiliary electrode. Okay, it's new. It's not a counter electrode. It's the auxiliary electrode. If you go to Australia, okay, they do everything. They copy everything that goes on in England. Okay, they call it the auxiliary electrode. That's the best British accent I could come up with. And on this side of the pond, okay, you know, across the pond, it's called the auxiliary electrode. But on this side of the pond, we call it a counter electrode. It doesn't matter. That's where the bulk of the current is flowing. Between the counter and the working electrode, no significant current is flowing to the reference electrode. Remember, we're going to use a voltmeter, an electrometer that has a very high input impedance, all right, that keeps the current from flowing and doesn't alter the composition of my reference electrode dramatically. Advantages of a three-electrode system. Changes in concentration at the counter or auxiliary electrode are not important. Okay, they don't affect the potential at the working electrode. No current is flowing through the system between the reference electrode and the working electrode, so there's no IR drop problem there where the measurement's being made. There is an IR drop on the between the working and counter, but nobody cares because we let the counter electrode do whatever it wants. It can run its potential at any value it wants to. All right, I said I was going to give you five applications. And I'm going to run through them real quick. The first one is the one that we've been talking about. All right, these are applications of what is really controlled potential electrolysis. Control the potential, electrolyze the solution, cause something to happen, use it in a constructive way as far as a chemist. Okay, so the first one is the actual electrogravimetry experiment. I'm doing quantitative analysis. I'm measuring the quantity of material that is plated out on the electrode by weighing the electrode. I can weigh things very accurately. We can use an analytical balance, four places after the decimal. We can use a five-place balance that we have in our lab, but we don't let anybody touch it, so don't even come and ask. Okay? Or you can even use a microbalance, a six-place balance. Right? There are a few of them around as well. And so we can make the measurement very accurately, very precisely, and as long as we meet the assumptions and deposit everything out of the solution and don't deposit anything else that is not of interest, then we've got really good ability to give good accuracy for this technique, really good accuracy and precision. I mentioned this. And it's good for high concentration levels. Gives you very, 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 very high accuracy at high concentration levels. Okay, it can work at low concentration levels as well. Okay, so that's the first application, quantitative analysis. The second application that I'm going to tell you about is a separation application. Obviously, what we were doing in our experiment is separating the copper ions from the solution. So I can do separations using the same technique. I'll give you an example. This is a real-world example. There is a company in New Hampshire, VH something laboratories, I can't even remember. Or not VCH, VH something, anyway, I forget. And they sent us some samples and they said, look, vitamins. These are vitamin samples. And we need to certify the concentration of zinc, and it has to be traceable to the National Institute of Standards and Technology. So we want you to titrate the zinc concentration with EDTA and determine the zinc value. However, there's copper in the solution also. It's a vitamin tablet that has copper and zinc in it. Get your minimum daily requirements of the zinc and copper. So they said the problem is if you titrate the zinc, you'll also titrate the copper. And the number that you get from the EDTA titration will be zinc plus copper. We don't want that. We just want the zinc value. What we want you to do is, we want you to do controlled potential electrolysis and remove the copper from the system and then titrate the sample for zinc. Not a problem. We can do that. So, put some electrodes in there, stir like crazy, apply an appropriate potential that will plate out the copper but not the zinc, and remove all the zinc from the system, and then titrate the zinc with an EDTA titration and get an accurate result. Accurate result for the copper. No, accurate result for the zinc, sorry. So, this is how you do it. Separate one species from another by selectively plating it out. Throw it away. you know, or you know, just wash the electrode off and dip it in acid to get rid of the copper. We don't care. What we want to do is remove an interferent. It's an interferent in the titration method. Now, because this separation technique works really well, electrochemists use it all the time. And in other words, if I'm doing electrochemistry and I want to measure something electrochemically, but there's something in the solution that is electrochemically active and creates an interference, I might be able to remove the interferent by electrochemically by separating it out of the solution and then doing the experiment that I want to do. So electrochemists use this a lot. But sometimes other people use it as well. So we've got quantitative analysis and we've got separations as applications of controlled potential electrolysis. You electrolyze the solution, you don't do the measurement by electrochemistry. You do the measurement by some other technique. Next, pre-concentration. Okay, here's an example. I mentioned to you earlier the ocean, seawater. Oceanographers want to go out and they want to measure the concentration of metals in the ocean. They want to know, for example, if Boston Harbor, which has historically been polluted and is notorious for its pollution, has higher concentration levels of cadmium, lead, whatever, than the open ocean. The problem is that the concentrations, even in a contaminated system like Boston Harbor, are still part per billion levels. Now, out in the open ocean water, it might be parts per trillion. And in the harbor, where things are contaminated by the runoff and the industrial waste and sewage and everything else that's going into Boston Harbor, you might say the concentrations are elevated, but they're still lower than what we're used to measuring. It's still part per billion levels. Low part per billion levels, in some cases sub part per billion levels, and that's high compared to what's going on out in the open ocean where it's part per trillion levels. So how do we measure it? How do we do it? Well, electrochemically, we can pre-concentrate it. We can do something to boost the concentration in order to measure the stuff. Now here's a trick that I saw some people do. Downstairs in the basement, we have an instrument known as an XPS. X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy. And so I got to do this. XPS is an X-ray technique that measures the concentrations of metals on the surface of the substance. So he took a piece of in this case it was actually graphite. He took a graphite electrode, took a sample of seawater, put the electrode in the seawater, electrolyzed the seawater. Plated out the metals onto the surface of the graphite, stuck the graphite into the instrument, and measured the concentration of the metals that were on the surface of that electrode. By electrolyzing the solution, putting the carbon electrode in there and plating, he could increase the copper concentration on the surface. He could layer after layer after layer of copper, and you do that for an hour, okay? Even if you take a small sample, a liter. Let's say you take a liter of seawater, and you get all of the copper that's in a liter of seawater onto the surface of this electrode, and then measure it in your XPS instrument, you have pre-concentrated, increased the concentration of the copper so that you could easily measure it. Okay? Now, there are hundreds of examples of this. I've seen people take a graphite tube from a graphite furnace atomic absorption instrument, stick it into a solution, clip a little alligator clip that goes to their potentiostat, use it as an electrode, plate out the metal, stick the graphite tube into the graphite furnace AA, hit the button, fire it off, and measure the amount of metal that was plated out onto the graphite tube. Now, that seems like a real lot of trouble to go through to measure it, but it pre-concentrates the metal. Not only does it pre-concentrate it, but you separated it from all of the other salt ions. If you're doing seawater, seawater is a pretty tough beast to plug into a graphite furnace AA. Okay, it really floods up the instrument with a huge amount of salt that produces scattering, light scattering. It's hard to do. So we can pre-concentrate the metals boost up their concentration in order to make a measurement. In electrochemistry, there are many examples of this. I will give you one later in a couple of classes where electrochemists, again, use this to increase the concentration of a particular species on the surface of an electrode and then measure what they got. Okay, they go fishing for something and catch a lot of it, and then they measure what they've got. They can't measure it when it's at the low concentration. They can only measure it when it's increased its concentration to some higher value that will allow them to readily measure it, readily measure it with their technique. So I got an example here. You can read this example. My example, I played out the stuff from a liter. I put it back in 1 milliliter. I've affected a 1,000-fold increase in concentration, and then I measure it by some technique. Any technique. Okay, so I covered quantitative analysis, separations, pre-concentration. Number 4 is electrosynthesis. Organic chemists can use oxidizing or reducing agents. Okay? A real powerful reducing agent would be something like lithium aluminum hydride. I'm afraid of it. Okay? It's powerful stuff. Okay, but I don't need that power all the time. Okay, well I'll go on the shelf and say, I know I've got one to do the reduction. I'll use sodium borohydride. I'm not really afraid of that, although I have produced hydrogen with it and had little explosions, really small explosions. So I can use sodium borohydride, but sodium borohydride is not as powerful as lithium aluminum hydride. And so if I go to use reagents off the shelf, you know, sodium dithionite or any reducing agent that you want to use, tin, you know, people use tin metal. Tin 2, tin, stannous chloride is a reducing agent. All right, so I only have certain levels of reducing power based on the reagent that I'm using. However, with an electrochemical system, I can dial in any level of reducing power I want. It's a continuous spectrum of any value that I want based on the potential that I set for my electrodes. So many organic chemists have taken advantage of electrosynthesis by setting up a potentiostat, setting up some big electrodes, because usually they want to use fairly large electrodes to get a lot of surface area, give a lot of the product that they're interested in. And I got a lot of advantages to electrosynthesis. I don't have to buy any reagents. Okay, I don't have a waste disposal problem with reagents or leftover reagents. I don't have to worry that the reagents go bad with time. Reactive chemicals often will go bad, oxidize or reduce on their own over time, and they won't be any good anymore. I don't have those problems. I also don't have the problem of picking the particular reducing agent that's powerful enough but not too powerful and so forth. I can just dial in whatever level of reducing or oxidizing power I need and do electrosynthesis. So it's just controlled potential electrolysis. I'm not measuring anything. I'm just producing some material, and I could do it at micro scale. I could do it at really small scale if I want to rather than large scale. So this is another advantage or another application of controlled potential electrolysis. My last application of controlled potential electrolysis is the purification application. And again, electrochemists use this all the time. I want to purify a solution. Remember when I did the separation experiment where I separated out the copper so I could measure the zinc? Well, this is sort of like that, except I want to separate out everything. And I want to make up a solution of some reagent that I want to use, but I don't want any metals or anything in there that's going to interfere. So I put the system, I put the solution into a system, electrochemical system, that plates out all of the stuff that I can plate out. Anything that I'm able to plate out is plated out, and then I pull off the reagent, and it's purified. It's ultra pure. If you go to the shelf in your laboratory and look at reagent grade chemicals, you find out that they're pretty dirty. That there's a lot of stuff in there. That there's a long shopping list of lead, less than 5 ppm. 5 ppm? I don't want 5 ppm of lead in my solutions. There's all kinds of stuff. If you actually went to the chemical plants where they make those reagent bottles, you know, they come in these beautifully white plastic bottles, and you open them up, and it looks as a beautiful crystalline substance. You go to the plant where they're making it, bottling that stuff. There's a guy with a shovel. I'm not kidding. A shovel. It's actually a plastic shovel. They usually use plastic shovels instead of steel shovels. But he's wearing rubber boots, you know, a mask, maybe one of those Tyvek, Mylar suits, jumpsuits. And he's in there, and he's shoveling, you know, sodium hydroxide pellets onto a conveyor belt. And down the line, they're going into nice little bottles that come off, off the end of the assembly line and come to your laboratory. And say, oh, look at this beautiful pure reagent, you know. And the guy goes, okay, bring the front loader in here. And they dump another load of sodium hydroxide pellets into the hopper. And the guy's shoveling them out, you know. It's not that clean, okay? They're not, those reagents are not that clean. They got quality control. They're making it look clean, but there are impurities in those reagents. And you say, oh, I'll just buy ultra-pure reagents. Great. If you've got the cash to buy ultra-pure reagents, go right ahead. But you could pay 10 times the amount of money for ultra-pure, nano-pure, whatever the name they're calling it this week is, Baker certified reagents. Okay, and they come with a little certificate, you know, that tells you all the stuff that's in there. Well, there's a lot of stuff in there that's not supposed to be in there. I can purify it in this way. Now, how do I do it? Well, this funny looking device, the working electrode is right here. Okay, it's a pool of mercury. I take the device, I pour mercury into the bottom of it. There's a piece of wire stuck inside into the mercury, and that is where I connect to my potentiostat. Potentiostat. Okay? So that's my box over here, and I connect that. Then I've got my solution in here, and I've got a counter electrode. So I connect that to potentiostat. But remember, it's a three-electrode system. So then I go over here to my reference electrode. Now, this says it's a saturated calomel electrode, an SCE. And it's in a double junction configuration. Remember we talked about double junction electrodes? I have no idea what he's talking about. I slept through that class. Okay. But it'll be on the test. And we will be having a test in 3 weeks, maybe. And so 3 weeks, time to sit up and pay attention. We got three electrodes. We put our solution in here. We may bubble nitrogen through there because remember that the things that are going on at the anode may affect what happens in the solution. So I may want to reduce the oxygen levels in the system. I may want to make an inert atmosphere. So we typically bubble an inert gas through the system. But inside there is my solution. It's sitting on top of a mercury electrode pool. On top of the mercury electrode pool is a stirring bar that floats on the mercury, okay? Because the mercury is very dense. So the Teflon stirring bar is floating on top of the mercury. And I'm stirring away, and I'm plating out all of the metals that are in that solution, and they're all going into the mercury. They're all being amalgamated with mercury. I'm making the mercury is picking up small amounts of copper, lead, cadmium, zinc, indium, antimony, bismuth, you name it, periodic table. Okay, things that will amalgamate with mercury or even plate out on the surface of mercury will be plated out of the system. I often have like a little spigot on the side, a little tube coming off here with a, stopcock in it, some kind of a valve. And after I've let it plate overnight, I come in the morning, take my clean bottle, leave the apparatus turned on, drain the solution out, and I have now a purified reagent, okay? Electrochemically purified. And it's a very good way to do it, very pure, and doesn't cost you anything. You might have to buy this cell. You got to have a potentiostat. If you're an electrochemist, you I've done a fair amount of electrochemistry in my lab. You go around, look on the shelf. There's three or four potentiostats. As a matter of fact, we probably have at least six. In the teaching lab, there's a whole bunch of them. There's at least three or four stuck over there. And got a lot of them around. We can set up a system like this and set it aside and let it run while we're doing other electrochemistry and purification. So we got five applications of this controlled potential electrolysis. Only one of them was actual analytical chemistry, the first one. Right? The first one was actually measuring something, the electrogravimetry. Let's see, what else can I tell you? I can tell you that we're all done with electrogravimetry, and we're going to talk about chronoamperometry. Now, electrogravimetry was the first technique, and I told you I'm going to cover 14 things. Right? And I'm going to do it. This is the seventh lecture, and I'm going to be done. I'm only giving you 11 lectures on electrochemistry. All right? So after today, 8, 9, 10, 11, there's four more lectures. All right? And then we'll be ready for an exam on electrochemistry. We're ready. We're excited about electrochemistry. Okay, so the next technique is chronoamperometry. Why chronoamperometry? Why name? Well, you know what a chronograph is, right? A chronograph is a watch. I don't own one. Who owns a watch? Does anybody have a watch? You don't have a cell phone, do you? Do you have a cell phone? See, what do you need a watch for? You got a cell phone. It's 9:02. All right, we still got a couple hours left. So a watch, another name for a watch is a chronograph, right? So chrono just means time. Amperometry, well, you know what amps are. Amps is current, right? And metry means measuring, right? So I'm going to measure time and current in this technique. That's all it means. It's a big word, but it means something. Chrono, amperometry just means current versus time. I'm going to measure current versus time. The basic experimental setup is shown here. All right, I'm going to use a stationary electrode. That's normally what we use. I'm going to use an unstirred system. So mass transport is by diffusion. I'm going to apply a constant potential, just like we did in electrogravimetry, controlled potential electrolysis. This is really controlled potential electrolysis, but I'm going to see what happens. I'm going to actually measure the current over time, okay, in this controlled potential electrolysis experiment. And that's what it says, measure current versus time. In the bottom part of my slide here, it says I'm going to do a reduction. This is just, I'm going to do a lot of reductions, but it's just, we could do an oxidation if we wanted to, but we're just going to do a reduction. Some oxidized species is going to go to red, some reduced species. What do I use before? I use iron, right? So iron 3 is going to go to iron 2. Chromium 6 is going to go to chromium 3. You name it, it's going to go to its reduced form. So ox is going to go to red. Both of them are soluble species, so we're not going to plate anything out like we did with the copper or systems like that. We're going to keep things in solution. Right? Now, there's a reason for that, and that'll become obvious. And it's a reversible reaction. What does that mean? It doesn't mean it goes forward and backwards. That's not what it means. It means it meets those assumptions that we talked about before, that the electrode kinetics are sufficiently fast that the concentrations of solution are in equilibrium with the applied potential according to the Nernst equation, right? And that the system is kinetically fast enough that it is mass transport controlled, not kinetically controlled. Okay, it's mass transport that controls what goes on in the system, the current that I observe that's measured at the electrode because stuff is being brought to the electrode surface. That is a mass transport controlled phenomenon. It's not controlled by the fact that the electrode kinetics are slow and sluggish and doesn't give me a good signal. Bless you. So that's what reversible means. You got to remember that because it's weird in electrochemistry. So that potential is set to, so reduction goes to completion at the electrode surface. So the stuff goes, hits the electrode surface, is converted completely to something else. So that's my setup. That's the basic system for the chronoamperometry. Okay? Chronoamperometry, as you can now see, follows the Cottrell equation. All right? So here's what happens. Output signal for chrono amperometry. I'm going to measure current versus time. Chrono is time. Amperometry, current. Right? I set up my system, put it together, flip the switch on, and the current jumps up to some value and then drops off with time. Drops off because it's a stagnant system. It's completely at rest. The only thing going on is diffusion. So I use up the stuff at the surface, and then more stuff needs to diffuse to get to cause current to continue. And as I deplete and deplete and deplete, things are going to diffuse further and further, and the current drops off because it's mass transport limited, not kinetic limited, mass transport limited. So the current drops off according to this blue line based on the Cottrell equation. But we're doing real-life electrochemistry now, and being real-life electrochemistry, there are real-life problems. And the real-life problem that we have is that there's another current in the system besides the Faradaic current causing that is caused by the reduction of the species of interest. There's something else going on in there. And what is that something else? That something else is the capacitive current flowing as electrons move to as charged species move in a potential field to line up at the electrode surfaces and create this sort of layered, double layer capacitive effect. And that current is an error or a problem, a non-ideal current or a interferent in this whole system. And so I've drawn this to show you that I got a Faradaic current that follows the Cottrell equation. I've got a capacitive current that decays exponentially, and it looks like this. Now, you say, oh, well, good thing the Faradaic current is bigger than the capacitive current. It doesn't have to be. Cottrell equation has C in it, concentration. If I have low concentration, I have low Faradaic current. So I could get to a situation where I have a really low concentration of material in the solution, and the capacitive current is bigger than the Faradaic current. And guess what? I can't tell the difference. I just measure current. And all I know is current. I'm measuring current, and the system is giving me both, and I don't know which is which. And it's a problem. This is what determines the detection limit in electrochemistry. I can't measure Faradaic current in the absence of capacitive current. There's always a component of each. If I have a significant component of capacitive current, I have a detection limit problem. If my concentrations are high enough that I'm measuring 99% Faradaic current, 1% error, maybe I can tolerate that. Okay? But this is the problem in electrochemistry, distinguishing capacitive current from Faradaic current, and that's what goes on in this experiment. Okay, so I Faradaic decreases because aux is used up, and it says I capacitive is high, but drops off with time. Okay, processes perturbing the system. Okay, so we're doing chronoamperometry. We have a fairly high detection limit as electrochemical techniques go, but we can analyze that curve. What curve? This curve. Okay, we can analyze this curve and tell something about concentrations in systems. As long as they're high enough above the capacitive current, we can measure them. Might be able to tell something about the chemistry of the system. We might do a lot of things with this particular curve. So, processes perturbing the system can cause data to differ from the Cottrell equation. So instead of getting that nice curve like that, I might have something else going on. I know that I have capacitive current dropping off exponentially, and so that may perturb the curve that I get. If the curve that I get looks really exponential, it may be all capacitive current. If the curve doesn't look quite so exponential but more like the Cottrell equation, then I might be in good shape. So this tells us a little bit that capacitive current's a big problem. Secondly, I might have coupled chemical reactions occurring. Chronoamperometry can tell you something about chemical reactions that go on in your system. So, for example, if I'm reducing ox to red, I might find that red dimerizes and produces A, and that A undergoes an electrochemical reaction to B at even at the potential that I have set. It's fixed for my system. That's going to affect the shape of the curve. I'm not going to get a curve like this if I've got this going on. Okay, I'm going to get some other curve. I might get a curve that, you know, comes down, but then you know, goes back up. Or as A is produced, it may go back up. Or it may never come all the way down because I'm continually producing things that are going to give me more current. So in the old days, when chronoamperometry was the only thing going, electrochemists came along and said, hey, we can actually understand some of the chemistry in the system using this technique. Simple systems give us a Cottrell equation type curve. Complicated systems that have other electrochemistry go on give us a curve that's different than the Cottrell equation. We can analyze the curve and say something about the chemistry that's going on in the system. Okay, so we can do analytical chemistry by measuring the concentration versus standards of a current versus concentration plot. That's a calibration curve, right? Current is my signal. Concentration is the of a standard. It gives me a calibration plot, and I do that at some fixed time. So in the curve that I showed you earlier, we can go back there, I guess. We can just pick a time. Let's pick a time. Pick a time right here. All right. I measure the current at that time. Let's say it's 10 seconds. Okay. So I put the system together, put the standard in there, flip the switch on, 10 seconds, measure the current. Dump that out, put a new standard in there, twice the concentration, flip the switch on, wait 10 seconds, write down the current. Okay. Plot a calibration curve of concentration versus current, put in an unknown sample, turn it on, wait 10 seconds, measure the current, pick the number off the calibration curve, I have analytical chemistry. I measured it. All right, I'm done. So that's the first thing. I can analyze the shape of the current time curve in order to study coupled chemical reactions. Now that gives me a little bit of advantage. There are better ways to do both of these, okay? But this is the basic, I'm building, right? The first experiment, we just electrolyze the solution, all right? Now we're electrolyzing it and watching what happens versus time and measuring the current. Okay, so we've taken a couple of baby steps here in electrochemistry. Chronoamperometry is important because it's a fundamental method which other techniques are based. Great. Will this ever work? I didn't test it before, and I never have any luck with this anyway. This slide says here are some valuable websites that you can go to. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned this, but you know this handout material on my website, PDFs, right? There's something there that says this always happens to me. I don't know why this happens. There's one handout that says electrochemistry for non-electrochemists. Okay, it's light reading. Okay, the handouts are not 50 pages long, somebody's dissertation, some book. They're 3-5 page articles that have lots of pictures, okay, and diagrams and things to help you understand the electrochemistry. So this is also a valuable resource for you. You can go to these websites and you can look at pictures of the instrumentation. These are manufacturers' websites, so remember, manufacturers lie. But they do have pictures of instrumentation, setups of electrochemical cells, background information on electrochemistry. A couple of them, I think the bioanalytical website and maybe the Princeton Applied Research website, a couple of them have historical articles, you know, on Michael Faraday, his biography, you know, and you don't have to read those, but you can if you want to. And so, but they'll tell you about all these different techniques. Stuff on electrodes, electrolyte solutions, voltammetry. Why do we need to bubble nitrogen through the system? Why de-aerate the solution? There's a little something on one of these websites about that. Why? How does this technique work? Okay, so there's a whole list of things that are there, and that's why I provided these things for you. All right, we done? No, we're not done. I told you there's chronoamperometry. There's also a technique called chronopotentiometry. Chronopotentiometry, time, potential, measure. Right, that's what the word means. Chrono is time. Okay, so we can. Got to get my pen back. Where's my pen? Come on, pen. Okay, so chrono is time. Potential is voltage, right? And this is measure. Okay, so we're going to measure the potential. In chronoamperometry, we measure the amps. We measure the current. In chronopotentiometry, we measure the potential. We're going to use a stationary electrode. We're going to do unstirred mass transport by diffusion. We're going to do constant current. EGADS, this is one of the two techniques, probably, that I'm going to talk about that will use constant current. I'm going to apply constant current. How do you do that? You use a galvanostat. What's a galvanostat? It's one of the handouts on my website. Explains what a galvanostat is, okay? Explains that it's a box, okay? It applies constant current, right? And allows you to measure how the potential changes if I force a fixed flux of electrons into my electrochemical cell. What am I going to do? What's going to happen? Well, I'm going to explain to you what's going to happen. We still have ox going to red. They're both soluble, reversible reaction, and we're going to look at the applied current and how it. We're going to look at the potential that's produced as ox is used up at the electrode surface, producing the reduced species. Okay. We saw this diagram before when I talked about Fick's laws. What it's saying is that material, it's that whole concentration polarization thing. We apply the current in this system, and it uses up ox at the electrode surface and produces red. Okay, so that's going on in the system. And we're getting this concentration polarization type scheme happening in our system in controlled potential, in chronopotentiometry. We're going to follow the Nernst equation, as always. Nernst equation is important. What happens, though, is there's a gradual change that occurs in the system as a gradual change in E. Right? This is E. We're measuring E, and we're applying a fixed flux of electrons, a fixed current to the system, and we're forcing ox to go to red. What happens? Ox goes to red. This gets bigger. This is going up. This is going down. That's going to change E, right? If red is going up and ox is going down and everything else is constant, right? All this stuff is constant. Then E is going to change based on the ratio of red and ox changing. So ultimately, there's a gradual change. Then ultimately the surface concentration of ox goes to zero. In order to sustain that current that we're applying to the system, the E must change, and it must change rapidly to some new value where it finds some other species that it can cause to undergo a reduction in the type of system that we're using. So what happens is we get a curve like this. Okay, a curve like this. When something's going on, when something's actually being reduced, in our case, we're going through this region. Okay, this region is that Nernstian region. That region that says there's a gradual change that occurs because ox and red ratio is changing. Once I use up ox, the potential, E, goes shooting up to some value where it finds something else that it can reduce. All right. So let's see, do I have some fancy animation? I do. There's an equation that governs what goes on in this It's chronopotentiometry. It's measuring the potential versus the time. And this equation, which is referred to as the SAND equation, this SAND equation tells me something about this time. Okay, tau, the transition time to the 1/2 power, the square root of t, of tau is equal to pi to the 1/2, square root of pi, NFAD, diffusion coefficient, concentration of the oxidized species being converted to the reduced species, and the current that I'm jamming into the system. Okay, that's how the sand equation works. So in other words, I'm looking at this transition that occurs because I am causing ox to go to red. I'm using up ox. Once I've used it up, the system still has to do something with those electrons, so it's got to move to a new potential in order to use up that current that's being pumped into the system. So it tells you what's going on here, right? At the start, no reduced species is present, so E's not defined. Okay, red is zero, and then we go through the system and we get to all through the middle section, the transition region here, this transition, ox is being converted to red. When ox is used up, we go shooting to some new value where we can get a new reaction to occur. Okay. In principle, you can do quantitative analysis by relating tau to the concentration, right? Tau to the concentration, right out of the sand equation. In reality, it's better to do it other ways. Chronopotentiometry illustrates a constant current situation in electrochemistry, and it's really poor at handling capacitive currents. I wanted you to just know what this is all about, okay? Know how this is done, because it's an example of a constant current technique, and I mentioned there's only two of them that we're going to talk about, and the other one is coulometry. We could spend another half an hour on coulometry, can't we? He said no. Make a note. Raul said no. This will reflect on his grade. Okay. All right. All right. We'll quit there. If you have any questions, feel free to.